KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Leonard Arrington was the first and only professional academic to lead the history department of the LDS Church. And one of the things that made his approach so unique for his time was his belief that you could separate history from religion. In other words, he figured you could tease out the sacred part of the Mormon story from the historical events that happened over time. But what Arrington always ran up against was this conflict between leaders who were trying to protect and promote their faith and scholars who just wanted to tell the unvarnished truth. As one scholar put it, the minute you start humanizing your religious icons, it's a threat to people who feel like theirs is the one true church. Gregory Prince has written a biography of Leonard Arrington, and today on the program he's joining us to talk about how the man changed our understanding of Mormonism. After the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio with a call out to you filmmakers out there, or those who've always wanted to make a film. On June 15th, we're hosting a screening, what we're calling an open screen night, and it's your chance to make a short documentary. Here are the rules. It can't be more than 6 minutes. It has to be real. It's a documentary. And that's kind of it. But here's the theme. The body is a temple. The body is a temple. There's $500 in it if you win. You can get the details at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Leonard Arrington. Now, if you're not an historian or someone who spent time exploring Mormon history, you may not know who he was. What he was always an active, loyal, devoted Latter-day Saint who became the first and the only professional academic to lead the history department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Gregory Prince calls Arrington the most important figure in 20th century Mormon history writing. And that's because Arrington ushered in this remarkable shift in the story of Mormon history. He encouraged openness and transparency, and Prince says he became the public face of what has come to be known as New Mormon History. It's an approach that ultimately put him in conflict with some in the LDS hierarchy, and Arrington was removed from that office after barely 10 years. Church leaders then cracked down on intellectuals and historians who delved a little too deeply into taboo subjects. And today in the program, Gregory Prince is joining us to talk about his biography. It's called Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. Gregory Prince is an independent historian and biographer. He specializes in Mormonism. He's co-author of a book about the LDS Church President David O. McKay. And he's here in Utah, we should say, in studio. We usually have him someplace else, but he's here to speak at the annual Mormon History Association conference. We'll give you a few details about that as we go along. But Gregory Prince, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here in person.
Well, I wanted to maybe begin a bit with the book that you wrote about David O. McKay, where you explore, as you say in the subtitle of that book, The Rise of Modern Mormonism. You've called McKay the most important Mormon of the 20th century. Do you still stand by that?
Yes.
I was thinking, I wonder if Gordon B. Hinckley in some way was, but no, you still say it's McKay.
I think for two reasons. One is his effect on the internal church, that he really did modernize it. And the other was on the external persona that he projected, which really brought the Mormon church into a different level in the public square, in the United States and even internationally. So I'll stand by that.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think was, we were just sort of chatting a little bit before we started here, that book still remains a significant sort of, I think, contribution to all of this. And you figure it still stands up?
It still stands up. The University of Utah Press, which published it and the Arrington book, says it's still their best seller. So it's had staying power.
Yeah.
And people who buy it tell me they read it. So, it has a continuing effect. And I've never been challenged on a single detail from that book, so I'm very pleased with that.
So that took 10 years. This took 11. Let's back up, because you talk about how you were casting around for another project, though not sure why you needed another project. You're a pretty busy guy. But you did, and you had this encounter with Leonard Arrington's daughter.
I spoke at the Logan Tabernacle several months after the McKay book was published, spoke on McKay,
yeah.
And afterwards, a woman came up to me, introduced herself. I had not met her previously. She said, "I'm Susan Arrington Madsen. Are you going to be in town tomorrow morning? Because if so, I'd like to meet you in town for breakfast." And we spent 3 hours, had a delightful conversation. But the bottom line was that she and her two brothers had appreciated the McKay book and wondered if I would be willing to do the biography of their father. That was an irresistible offer.
What did they like about the McKay book that they thought made them think you could do justice to their father's story?
I think that it told the story in candor, in balance, and that's what they wanted for their father. I view the two figures really as peers in their respective areas. Certainly McKay's reach was much broader and much longer.
Sure.
But if you look at Mormon history, most people that you would survey would put Leonard right at the top of that pyramid.
I'll just put it straightforwardly. Are his kids still active Mormons for the most part?
Two out of three.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the one that approached you, because here's the question, and I wanted to know how you dealt with this throughout. Leonard Arrington, you mentioned in the book, was always proud of the fact that he was an active, engaged, temple recommend holding Mormon. He was proud of that. When he came into conflict with leadership, he always worried about that. And so I'm wondering how you dealt with that fact that he was in, but he also had conflicts, that he also expressed some concerns. I mean, how did you deal with that, and what did the family say to you about that?
The family was marvelous throughout. When I gave them what was my completed manuscript, they didn't suggest a single change. They never tried to steer where my research was going. They were very cooperative when I was interviewing family members. So it was a beautiful relationship there. Leonard had his doubts.
Yeah.
And some of those doubts he resolved. Some of them he didn't. He was just able to put them on the shelf. There was no pushback from the family in my either researching those doubts or writing about them. And when I gave the Arrington lecture at Utah State University a couple of years ago, that was the whole treatise that I talked about, was Leonard Arrington and doubt and faith.
Yeah. How did he manage it? How did he manage to stay completely faithful and yet have these questions about church history, have these doubts?
I think a lot of it went back to his earliest days in college at the University of Idaho.
Yeah.
He grew up outside of the Great Basin. He grew up in Twin Falls, Idaho, which to some people who don't know the terrain sounds like Mormon country, but it wasn't. Idaho Falls is Mormon country. So he was in a very small religious minority when he grew up, but he was in a very steadfast Mormon family.
Yeah.
Much of the time that he was growing up, his father was either a high councilman or an LDS bishop.
Right.
So I think that's where he got his roots within the tradition. His boat was in that stream, and it never left. When he got to college, he admitted quite candidly in his diary, "This is the first time I have had an intellectual struggle," because he was confronted with issues, the first one being organic evolution.
Right. I want to ask you about that, actually, because this was – he mentioned this was his first struggle. And then there's a man named George Tanner who comes into the story who becomes important, I guess, to help him sort of work out that intellectual question.
And George Tanner was a looming figure in his life, I think both intellectual and spiritual.
Yeah.
Because here was a man who was the director of the LDS Institute of Religion at the University of Idaho. He had wrestled with a lot of these subjects, and he felt that his students, in order to own their religion, and I think that's an important term, needed to get into the wrestling rink as well. He guided them, but he didn't do their thinking for them. He allowed them to go whatever direction they needed to go in their own wrestling match and just nudged them occasionally to try to show them that there was a way through this rhetorical minefield.
But how did he manage that particular question of organic evolution? Because you had kind of an interesting history. You had people like James Talmadge who had managed to work out some sort of middle ground between the creation and the idea of evolution. So there was a history of that. But at the time Arrington is coming of age, there's a lot of skepticism about the idea of evolution. So how did he manage it?
He managed it, I think, primarily because he learned to trust science.
Yeah.
He didn't need to know all the details. He was not a scientist himself.
Right.
But I think he was comfortable to say science does what it does and the arc of it goes in a positive direction, even if it's not a straight line arc. Hmm. And the religionists are doing their best to try to retell the story to keep up with where science is going. The religionists generally have a difficult time doing that. He had an easier time, I think, because he was willing to trust science and say, all right, religion will catch up to that. Whereas others who had a difficult time said, no, religion is the font of all knowledge regarding creation. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we must distrust science. And if that's where you live, that's going to be an area of continual tension.
There is one of the things that made this book similar, the Arrington book, similar to the McKay book you mentioned, is the amount of material. Arrington kept a diary, a huge diary with, thousands and thousands of pages, I guess you had to go through.
Well,
is that right?
It's relative.
Yeah.
His was only 20,000 pages. McKay's was 40,000 pages.
Right?
Both of them were an embarrassment of riches, though.
Yeah.
We have very few people who have been diarists to that extent. So with that as a starting point, you got a lot to work with. And then Leonard was really a pack rat.
Yeah.
His papers, which are deposited at the Utah State University Special Collections, amount to some 300 linear feet. I can't imagine that large a collection of personal papers. But that was the starting point. And then I did what I did with the McKay book, and that is to conduct a lot of interviews of the people who were in his family, who worked with him, peers within the historical arena. And that's what really gives a biography, I think, the third dimension.
Now, this is interesting because you mentioned early on in the book, in fact, there's this epigraph you have right at the top, this sort of dedication, where you say the book is dedicated to all who believe, and then this in quotes, that truth has got to be preserved. And I want you to tell the story of that particular moment because this is something that comes from the Mormon poet and writer Carolyn Pearson.
Yes. She shared a diary entry with me, and that's where the quote came from.
Yeah.
It wasn't a reminiscence. It was a real-time entry that she made, discussing with him some difficulties that she was having getting some of her materials published in the LDS Church magazines. And this was his response, that no matter how difficult...
Well, she had written a piece for the Ensign magazine,
Ensign,
and they ditched it.
Yes.
Right? They tore it. They said she couldn't do it.
Yep. Yep.
Because she had supported the Equal Rights Amendment.
It had nothing to do with the text itself.
Right.
Yes, it was a political
move. But they pulled it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the course of their discussion, he makes this impassioned plea that we have to preserve the history, that there is something that is not only valuable but sacred about truth. And if you don't preserve it or if you try to cover it up and muddy it, then you're going to pay a price in the long run, and that's a price we don't want to have to pay.
She writes this. You include this section from her diary. She said in her conversation with Arrington, she said, "In fact, he said to me he's enough of a realist that he makes two copies of his journal, one that stays in his office and another that goes home with him." What's that about? Why did he do that?
I think that's the same mentality that Claire Middlemiss, who was David O. McKay's secretary, had. She actually wrote his diary. Some would call it an office journal, but she took dictation from him and then added other documents. His wish was that the diary go to his children. As he was nearing the end of his life, she was smart enough to see the politics and realize that wasn't going to happen. So she quietly began to make a complete photocopy of the 40,000 pages, which she kept in her basement, not just to have a second copy, but she had hoped to be his biographer. But there was also an inherent distrust of the system that maybe somebody will view this record as inimical to the interests of the church, and who knows what will happen then. I think that's what was guiding Leonard there as well.
Yeah.
He had seen enough history that was being sequestered. I don't know that he saw any that was being destroyed, but certainly that would be a fear, and he didn't want that to happen to his personal record.
It's interesting. Carolyn Pearson says he was enough of a realist, but your sense of him, maybe that he was a realist in part, but it seems like one of the characteristics you talk about for Leonard Arrington was that he was naive.
Oh,
he wasn't a realist in some cases.
Politically, yes, he was naive. In terms of history, this man had mastered the subject matter. He probably had read as much content in the LDS Church archives as anybody has ever read. But when it came to political intrigue, he was clueless. He spent 26 years of his professional career at Utah State University as a professor of economics. Never taught a history course there because of the politics up there. He bypassed several times the opportunity to become an administrator. He didn't want to be a department chairman. He didn't want to be a dean. He just wanted to research and to write. Lecturing was really his third choice in what he would like to do with his day. So all of a sudden, never having had any administrative experience, he's transplanted from a small university in rural Utah to this large, sprawling LDS bureaucracy and asked to create a new bureaucracy within the existing bureaucracy. He has no clue that LDS political intrigue is at least as complex as Vatican political intrigue. And yet there he is, and all of the sudden he's asked to function in this environment. He doesn't have the tools for it.
And not only that, with a subject so fraught, I mean, history. And as you say, runs headlong into it. He's naive, and then he comes into conflict with things that we'll talk about here as we go along. Let me ask you this before we get to a break, though. Put Arrington in context for us. What's so significant about the fact that he was the only professional academic to ever serve as LDS church historian? Like, what's significant about Leonard Arrington?
Well, the reason that happened is that the church had grown from a very small organization that was pieced together over decades. Now it was a very large organization, and that structure was insufficient. So in the early 1970s, the church brought in an Eastern consulting firm and said, give us a top-to-bottom review of this. Tell us how we need to restructure it. Hmm. One of their recommendations was you need to professionalize the historical department. That's why it happened. After it happened, then you start to see output from the historical department that just blew people away because it was so new and refreshing.
Yeah. But then they retreat, the church, after Arrington. I guess, and we'll come back to this as we go, the experiment with professionalizing the history department, at least some in the hierarchy said, that's an experiment we don't like. That didn't work.
And it didn't take long for those storm clouds to start to appear.
Yeah, which we'll get to. Gregory Prince is with us. His new big epic tome here is called Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He is in town for the Mormon History Association's annual conference, which gets underway today. It runs through Sunday. It's at the Snowbird Resort. Of course, he's speaking on Leonard Arrington tomorrow afternoon, and there's a link to conference information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the biographer and historian Gregory Prince is joining us to talk about Leonard Arrington. Arrington was a respected historian, the first professional academic to head the history department of the LDS Church. He led this remarkable change, opened records, and was candid, was objective, gave outsiders access, encouraged Mormons to embrace their real history. This openness didn't always sit well with some in the church hierarchy. He was removed from his office after about 10 years of that experiment. A number of scholars after that faced church discipline. Gregory Prince's book is called Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He's in town in Utah to speak at the annual Mormon History Association conference. We'll give you some particulars about that a little bit later on the program. Well, we were sort of chatting about one of the charming elements of the story that I liked, and that he had this deep affection for chickens growing up, and always did love chickens, I guess.
Well, it was a better alternative for him. He grew up on a farm. He hated field farming. And so the compromise that he struck with his father was to raise chickens.
Yeah.
And it just became a defining factor of his life. He loved chickens, and it became a metaphor, really, for a lot of the things that he did.
And away from to practice his speaking skills.
Yes. Yeah? Yes. His sister told me that when he was a teenager and was working in the Future Farmers of America, he had to deliver speeches, and he would practice them by going out to the chicken house and talking to the chickens.
Now, one thing I wanted to come back to, and you referenced this a little bit earlier, Arrington grows up outside of the Great Basin, which is significant in this way. Because he went to World War II, he didn't serve an LDS mission. He had no contact, you say, with the pioneers and their stories that people growing up in Utah would have. And so in that sense, he didn't have the kind of defensiveness that comes from this sense of persecution. He hadn't been personally persecuted, for example, for his faith. Was that significant, do you think, in the way he perceived the world? He didn't have a persecution complex, it seems. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. And he didn't have the received story that so many Mormons in the Great Basin had. What he did was to figure it out on his own.
Yeah.
And he did it through intellectual inquiry, through extensive reading, through wrestling with it. And so that put him on, I think, a much firmer ground. He owned his story. He yeah. owned his religion. And many of his co-religionists borrowed theirs. They just leaned on what was passed down to them.
Do you think, I'm thinking about the spate of Mormon essays now that have been released relating to, and they're quite candid about Mormon history. The question, for example, of Joseph Smith's sort of controversial history with polygamy is one. Did Leonard Arrington ever encounter things like that? I don't know if you know in particular about whether he encountered the fact of Joseph Smith's sort of dodgy relationship with polygamy, and did that make him struggle in terms of his faith? Do you know?
I don't think that that was an issue for him. I think he was able to look at the data points to figure out if the data were reliable, and in his judgment and in my judgment, those data points are reliable, and that allowed him to reconstruct the story without any existential crisis. The one area where he really struggled and never really resolved it was the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
For him, the possibility of the Book of Mormon being a 19th century document instead of a literal translation of an ancient artifact was existentially threatening.
Yeah.
And he never got to a point where he was able to take all of the data and work through them and come to a new paradigm. He had to shelve some of those data and go with a story that gave him comfort but circumvented some of the data.
And the story that gave him comfort was the Mormon story that this had been passed down by – he was translated as opposed to written by Joseph
yes,
Smith.
Yes, yes. Yeah. He was willing to concede, as some other scholars did, that maybe there are some bits of modernism that crept into it, but he held to that ancient model.
Now, he's referred to as an historian, but let's make this clear. His PhD was in economics. He loved economics. And you mentioned sort of the political dynamics at Utah State University and within the history sort of community itself. On some level, he wasn't, at least at first, accepted. Because he didn't have a PhD. It wasn't seen as legit, I guess. Is that right?
Well, he had enough credentials that he at least could get a faculty position there. He joined the faculty at Utah State in 1946. His PhD dissertation was filed in 1952 at the University of North Carolina. So it was like – it wasn't even provisional because that's the way they did it then. Now you wouldn't be able to get a tenure-track job at all if you didn't have the PhD in hand. His PhD was in economics. It was on the topic of the economic history of the Great Basin, of the Latter-day Saints within the Great Basin. But he readily acknowledged when he got to Utah State that it was almost unreadable and that he didn't know anything about how to write history. And that's where he fortunately and yet later unfortunately came under the influence of George Ellsworth, who was on the history faculty at Utah State, a superb historian, but one who was so precise in his historical writing that his output was not very great. He taught Leonard how to write history, and Leonard completely retooled his dissertation. It took him several years to turn that 1952 document into his 1958 The Great Basin Kingdom, which was published by Harvard University Press. The Great Basin Kingdom is readable. I've looked at the dissertation. It's not. And the difference was that George Ellsworth put him through the hoops and turned him into a good writer. But that relationship unfortunately soured because George saw that Leonard's quantity, even though it couldn't match his own quality, was getting the limelight.
Yeah, it seems like he's always dealing with political sorts of things. But I think that one of the points you make in the book is that Arrington's skill wasn't necessarily in writing history. It was accommodating the work of other historians. Is that right?
Absolutely right. Great Basin Kingdom, by any measure, was his high water mark. You could argue what second or third, but I would put second and third way behind number one. And a lot of the things that came out under his name, either articles or books, were not very good. Mm-hmm. The level of the scholarship, the level of the writing often depended on who the ghostwriter was, because Leonard, once he became the church historian, did not have time to do that. So he had to rely on others and didn't even have enough time, I think, to pay careful attention to the details of what they were doing. So it was a very mixed bag.
He becomes then the church historian. This is in 1972. I wanted to ask you about a couple of the players that are significant. Howard W. Hunter is an apostle at the time. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's interesting is Hunter believed the church was, as he put it to Leonard Arrington, that the church was mature enough that our history should be honest. So he has an advocate in Howard Hunter?
Terrific advocate in Howard Hunter, who was also the church historian at the time.
Right, right. So let me ask you about that. And I want to ask some of the players here. Just quickly, we can go through a few of these. So we mentioned Howard W. Hunter and Eldon Tanner. What's the role he plays? He's an interesting character.
Tanner was the counselor in the First Presidency who reached out even before he called Leonard to be the church historian. He was part of this reorganization process and had leaned on Leonard and other historians for some guidance as they were restructuring. But he was the one who issued the formal call, was very supportive of what Leonard was doing. Unfortunately, the mandate that Leonard was given by Tanner and by Hunter and later by Harold B. Lee as church president was never written down, and that came back to haunt him.
Yeah.
But initially, the supporters that he had were the ones who had all the powerful positions, and they were uniformly behind him.
But where was Joseph Fielding Smith?
Joseph Fielding Smith had been the church historian since the early 1920s.
Now, the rap on Joseph Fielding Smith from critics is that he, because of his obviously intimate relationship with church history, that he was, if not hiding, at least obscuring the real history of Mormonism and not letting a lot of sort of the warts of the Mormon story out.
And not giving scholars access to the documents.
Right.
Correct. If you read his Essentials in Church History, which was a one-volume survey history that he published, I think the first edition was 1922, and it remained in print until after his death in 1972, compare that with the history that Leonard and his co-workers started to produce, and that tells you all of the difference that you need to know between the two worldviews. Smith's was polemical history. It was based on one premise, and that is that the only legitimate function of history is to promote the faith.
Yeah.
And if anything isn't promoting the faith, it doesn't get in there.
Right.
And it doesn't get out to the scholars.
Yeah. Arrington's view was polar opposite of that, was it not? I mean, and this was something that he figured, and maybe this was naive, that you could strip out the sort of sacred part to tell the history part. Is that about it? Is that right?
Yes. I think that he realized that there are two types of knowledge when it comes to religion.
Yeah.
One is knowledge that's verifiable.
Yeah.
And the other is knowledge that isn't. How do you prove on a piece of paper that there is the existence of a God? I think he, more than most scholars and even more most ecclesiastics of his time within the LDS tradition, realized the difference between those two and was able to accommodate both and not try to do too much overlap. He was secure in his own spiritual skin. And I think that was largely on the basis of having grown up in a very supportive family where your boat was in the stream and it worked.
Yeah.
That part didn't concern him, so that I think he was comfortable going to the other part saying, all right, if it's verifiable, then we need to verify it. And he was not threatened that there was a possibility that the faith side of it would be negatively impacted if he just told the story.
Yeah. He wrote this at the time, right around 1972. He says, I cannot see that I can handle things significantly differently than I have done previously as a professional at the university. That sounds crazy naive. No? He's like, I can do what I want here. I think I can, because he has this idea, this new approach, right? We're going to take this new approach, and I don't see any reason why I can't pull this off.
Yes, politically it was naive, but professionally it was totally in line with what his experience has been.
Right.
He's been an academic. What do academics do? They seek to find the truth, and then they publish it. And he felt that that was all that he needed to do. It really was the foundation that he laid and what his coworkers felt they needed to do as well, and that that would take care of itself. It didn't.
Yeah.
He walked into what turned out to be a political minefield, and he stepped on quite a few mines.
We mentioned Hunter. He's supportive. We mentioned Tanner. He's supportive. There were others in the hierarchy who were as well. Hubie Brown, I expect, was.
Brown was not a significant figure by then.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Because Brown had been released from the First Presidency when McKay died in 1970. Yeah. Leonard came in 2 years later.
But he had his supporters.
Yes.
Now, let's mention those who were suspicious. Some of the more sort of ideological doctrinaire members of the 12. And help me out here. Boyd K. Packer?
Not a major influence early on, right, because he was junior. He went into the quorum in 1970 after McKay's death.
But Benson. Benson,
the primary figure on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
Benson was a senior apostle. Markey Peterson was next in line after Benson. They became the two antagonists who drove the train in the opposite direction. Both of them born at the end of the at the end of the 19th century. Benson, 1899, Peterson, 1900. These men grew up in an era where they heard the stories of persecution from the people who had been persecuted.
Right.
It was personal to them. And so they felt, and I think with justification, if you can see where they were coming from, they needed to protect that part of the church. And that's what they were defending. So now there's a new world order that comes in, and that's what the clash was. It wasn't personality versus personality. It was two philosophies that clashed.
How long did it take for that things to start going awry? Pretty soon, I guess.
I wonder, really, if it might not have happened within weeks or even days of when Leonard went in there. There was one story that I heard where two people got on the elevator, Leonard being one of them, and as they got on, they noticed that Ezra Taft Benson was on the elevator.
Wow.
And Leonard, always cheery, says, Elder Benson, this is my friend so-and-so. And Benson just looked straight forward, didn't move, didn't say a thing. He says, well, I think you know some of his family. Still didn't move, didn't say a thing. And the impression at that time was, we got a problem here.
Yeah.
Now, whether that really foreshadowed what the epic battle was going to be, I don't know, but I think it did foreshadow that, because I think that from the outset, probably Benson and Peterson and Packer had approved of the reorganization of the historical department, probably because it was an omnibus bill, to use the congressional analogy.
Right, and they didn't know what it meant.
There's this major restructuring of the entire church bureaucracy. It's an up-and-down vote. Yes, okay, we've moved forward. And then they started to realize, uh-oh, we got a problem in the historical department now. And so I think that that realization happened very early, and I think that these men were watching very carefully, almost from the outset, to figure out how can we reverse this.
Yeah. What was the relationship like between Mark E. Peterson and Ezra Taft Benson? That was kind of an odd competition going on there.
There may have been competition at a personal level. I never got into that. But on this issue, they were of one mind.
Yeah.
It was generally Benson who took the lead, maybe because his personality was that way, and maybe because of the seniority issue, that he was senior in age and in the quorum. But he certainly became the primary mover trying to disassemble what Leonard was trying to assemble.
Right. You say that Arrington failed to appreciate the worldview of the apostles, what you were just talking about there. They had this idea of this sort of heroic history. And what's interesting to me is you say that there's this view in Mormonism that the fact that the early saints prevailed from this persecution was proof that Mormonism was the one and the only church and the true church. And you say this idea of proof, of proving, and I'm wondering if I get this right, continues to be in some ways the nature of the quest for some Mormon scholars, even still, this idea of proof and proving.
Yes. I started to get into collecting Mormon books way before I had any notion that I would write anything. And I've got about 10,000 plus volumes in my personal library that go back really to the beginning of Mormonism. Most of those volumes either attempt to prove that Mormonism is the one and only true church or to disprove that Mormonism is the one and only true church. And so they represented the two polar extremes of looking at a religious tradition, with neither side realizing that's a fool's errand. You can't do that. There are some of those elements of it, such as the nature or even the existence of God, that are beyond objective proof. So lay off of that and deal with the things that you can discuss in an objective fashion. There are still, as you say, a lot of scholars within the Mormon tradition who are still in that polar position. We are going to prove that, and then you fill in the blank. Leonard was not of that type, and he said that in the introduction to Great Basin Kingdom. It was a beautiful introductory essay that looked inward and outward and said to the outward people, look, this is by nature a religion, so some things we can't prove, but look at the effect and at least have some respect that the cause of that effect may have been something extraordinary. Then he looked inward and said, look, folks, there's some things that we can't prove, and so we're just going to have to go with the data and go no further. So he was trying to look at both directions and do that balancing act. But then what he wrote was not an attempt to prove or to disprove. It was to tell the story, and he was comfortable that that would be a benign influence on the church.
Gregory Prince is with us. His new book is called Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He's here in town for the Mormon History Association's annual conference. It gets underway today. It runs through Sunday. It's at the Snowbird Resort. Greg is going to be speaking on Leonard Arrington tomorrow afternoon. There's a link to all of the particulars on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Gregory Prince. We're talking about his new book, Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He's in Utah for the Mormon History Association's annual conference. It gets underway today. We'll give you a little few more particulars later on the program. Here's a question from Brian, who writes from American Fork. Has anyone within the LDS Church leadership shown or expressed regret for the treatment of Arrington, especially considering his openness likely would have saved the church some embarrassment? Do you know?
None has expressed that sentiment to me, but that's not a discussion that's an easy discussion to have.
Yeah. Really? So no one said, oh, I wish we would have thought differently. I mean, I guess the question is, and we'll come back to this actually a little bit later. Let me hold off because I want to have you get a sense of what is Leonard Arrington's effect on the modern church today. Mm-hmm. So hold off on that for a moment, because I want to talk about a couple of other stories. One that comes up, and it's not necessarily related to history, but I think it reveals something. Well, it is related to history in many ways, but it reveals something about Leonard Arrington. And this was the story of the forger and convicted murderer Mark Hoffman, which is a section in the book. And of course, he's finding in the early 80s dozens of these amazing documents that, of course, turn out to be forgeries. And you say in the book, Arrington should have been skeptical, but he wasn't.
He wasn't. He was quite gullible, as were most of the Mormon historians. I think there's a huge irony in the fact that the very first person to raise the red flag and say something's fishy about this was Gerald Tanner.
Yeah.
Who had a lot to gain.
Now, mention who Gerald Tanner is, because he's a significant critic of Mormonism.
One of the most significant. He almost invented the genre of anti-Mormon writing.
Right.
He started a little operation called Modern Microfilms that's now Utah Lighthouse Ministry.
Yeah.
And his quest was, I don't know so much that it was to try to disprove Mormonism as to say, look, here are the records. Let's be honest. And let's see what the story tells. And he said to his wife, who was not skeptical about the Hoffman documents, there's something that's too convenient here. I'm suspicious of this. But none of the Mormon historians went down that road for a long time. And even through the arrest of Hoffman, Leonard was still skeptical that this man could have done the forgeries that he was being accused of.
Yeah.
So Leonard doesn't get high marks on that one.
Right.
I think given—
And neither does the Mormon History Association.
Correct.
I mean, you mentioned that four historians give a presentation, said the Salamander letter was authentic. People know what the Salamander letter is. Most people anyway. It's one of these controversial documents that Hoffman forged. And anyway.
Yeah. Well, but Hoffman's ploy was very clever, and that was to lean enough on known history that it would sound authentic, but to put some juicy things in there that then became irresistible. He was very smart.
Yeah. There's one story here that I think is interesting, because you mentioned that so Hoffman has found a document where Joseph Smith had designated his son to be the next president of the Mormon Church. And at first the LDS Church says, nah, we're not really interested in that. And Hoffman's like, are you crazy? Of course you should be interested in this. And then the RLDS Church, or then the reorganized church now called the Community of Christ, they were like, we'll buy it. We're really interested. And then the church gets interested. The LDS Church gets interested. And Gordon B. Hinckley believes the church should buy it. And so they do. But you say, and this was really intriguing, I want to ask you about this. You say that Arrington tries to leverage the purchase of this document to get access to this document he had never seen. The minutes of the book of the so-called the Council of the 50.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell that story? I'm really intrigued by this.
Well, this is one of those documents that was known to exist. The Council of 50 was a quasi-church organization in that was organized by the church in Nauvoo. But it didn't just include Mormons. It was with the intent of preparing to build a literal kingdom of God, a political kingdom. And so it had non-Mormons on the Council of 50 as well. And that has been a highly guarded document ever since, although as part of the Joseph Smith Papers Project now, that will be published. This is one of those things where Leonard would just be incredulous now. And he wanted to get into that not only because of his historian's curiosity, but he felt that there were going to be some indicators in there that might allow them to decipher some of the stuff that was going on with Hoffman. But it was a no-no. He couldn't get access to it.
What was the final straw for Leonard Arrington? This was 1982 when they finally think the church says no. And they shuffle him off to Brigham Young University.
Yep. He could— he could see this coming eventually. He should have seen it much earlier. And if he had seen it, if he'd had the political tools, he may have been able to prolong what they called Camelot.
I don't know
that he could have preserved it indefinitely, because the timing was just not right. These men who were the antagonists of his New World Order, not antagonists of him personally, were too powerful. And I don't know that he could have avoided the conflict entirely. But eventually, even with his political naivete, he saw we're doomed. And reluctantly, they had to set their sights elsewhere. I think that Homer Durham, who is often portrayed with a darker hat, deserves a lighter hat on this because he was given...
Who's Homer Durham?
Homer Durham was inserted as the general authority over the historical department and was given the mandate to disassemble the history division. Not the whole department. There were four divisions within it. There was library, archives, historical sites, and history division. That's the one that was dissolved and sent down to BYU. Durham acted, I think, as best he could with a lousy hand that he was dealt. Mm. And they created the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Church History at BYU. They gave all of those who were in Leonard's division the opportunity to move down there. They actually had an increase in salary. It was, in a way, an ideal setting for them because they had no academic duties. They were allowed just to go down there and write history. But most of them felt this was a real demotion to them. It took the wind out of Leonard's sails. And a real double tragedy is that within weeks of when they finally took the sign off the door in church headquarters and the history division was no more, Leonard's wife died after a long illness. And it just, it tore his heart out.
Yeah. You mentioned Arrington's standing as a church member was so important to him, and he began to wonder if he was seen as being out of favor. There were even questions about blacklists in those days. Was he on a blacklist? Was he seen as being out of favor?
Apparently, at times he was on a blacklist. Yeah. He had been asked to write a column for the Church News, the weekly newspaper that the church publishes, and abruptly that stopped. You tend not to be told directly that you're on a blacklist. You have to connect the dots.
Yeah.
And he connected those dots. He worried later when he was publishing his autobiography if he might be excommunicated. And that's a tragic thought for him to have had for all that he did in his lifetime. But he really feared that because that was the climate that still pervaded the church in the late 1990s.
There was a period, and I don't want to say a lot about it because I want to actually get you on the program and talk about this a little bit later, but there was this period that happens and like 10 years of there was the so-called September 6th where intellectuals and scholars who were probing too deeply were disciplined, in some cases excommunicated. And then the church seems to have kind of pulled out of that a little bit. What happens after that in 1982? What's going on here?
Well, the September 6th were 1993.
Right.
In the immediate aftermath of the dissolving the history division, Mark Peterson at least felt emboldened to move the needle even farther in the direction that he wanted it to go.
Now, these were called witch hunts.
Yes, that was what it was called, and I think it qualifies. That he had some of his assistants draw up what basically was a hit list of historians who had published things that he didn't like. And then he personally got on the phone to stake presidents and gave them instructions to bring these people in. And he didn't say excommunicate them, but he said something like to restore order. He knew the code words. I don't think that any of those people were excommunicated, but for some of them, it was a very brutal process that they went through. I was very close to one of those on the east end of the United States because one of my closest friends was one of the people on that list. It turned out his stake president was a savvy guy who played it perfectly and later told me, you know, Elder Peterson called me and told me to rough him up, and he said, I wouldn't do it because it was wrong. But there were other stake presidents who wouldn't have challenged the mandate. It was a very sad period, and it really cast a dark shadow over Mormon historiography that kept lingering, and then it reached a peak in 1993 with the excommunications. And that really took about two generations of Mormon historians out of the picture.
Yeah.
The younger ones realized there's no future for me here, and they left the field. And the older ones often would say, I'm just going to retreat to safe ground rather than to continue to write what I was writing. We paid a heavy price for that. And it's only now that we're getting these bright young people coming into the field and bringing very sharpened academic tools with them, and we will all gain because of that.
And that's the legacy of Arrington?
That's part of the legacy. I think that you can look at his most lasting legacy as being two things. One is that he laid a foundation that current Mormon studies are being built upon. A metaphor that I think of as the Salt Lake Temple, where it was, the construction began in 1853, but 4 years later, when Johnston's army approached Utah, Brigham Young was determined that they weren't going to do anything more than they could get away with. And so he ordered the foundation to be covered up completely so that the troops wouldn't even know where the temple was. He didn't want them to defile it. It took another decade for them to uncover that foundation. Then they built the temple. That's what Leonard did. He built the foundation that then lay hidden for a couple of decades, and now look at what's being built on it. The other legacy is that he was a mentor. His daughter said at his funeral, she was astounded at how many people came up to her and said, "Let me tell you what your father did to promote my career." And it wasn't just for the professionals. His wings spread so broadly that even the interested amateurs were brought into the fold and encouraged.
Are you optimistic? There's the, right at the end of the book, you mention, you ask how far Leonard's ripples will extend and what their effect will be, are questions to be addressed by future generations of historians. Some you've talked to have not been so optimistic. Do you feel optimistic?
Yes, I do. And I feel particularly optimistic because in the intervening years, we have this thing called the internet, and it has been a permanent and an enormous game changer in just about every arena of life for us. It has democratized data. So we're no longer in the era where you can even play the game of we're going to control the message by controlling the data. The data are out there, and because everything is instantaneous on the internet, you can't get away with an inferior message anymore. Particularly the younger kids who live on the internet will call you out immediately. And so this is what has pushed the church to more and more transparency. It was behind the writing and the posting of those essays that you referred to earlier, the realization we need to get our story out there, because if we get called out as telling the story falsely or only partly telling it, we're going to pay a huge price. So yes, I'm very optimistic going forward. There'll be bumps in the road, but we'll get there.
Gregory Prince. His book is Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. He's going to be talking about his book as part of the Mormon History Association's annual conference, which runs today through Sunday. He's speaking tomorrow afternoon. You can get the particulars on our website, radiowest.org. Gregory, good to see you. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.